Coming up, we had to wait 50 years to see someone go back-to-back at the Players, bidding its world number one, Scottie Scheffler, rewriting the record books at TPC Sawgrass by defending his title with the Monster Sunday. What made the 50th edition of the Players so special? That's coming up as Golf Today starts right now.
Golf Today.
Nicklaus never did it. Same story for Woods, Trevino, Floyd, Price, McIlroy. None of these current or future Hall of Famers won the Players in back-to-back years. Scottie Scheffler becoming the first to do so on Sunday, and he saved his best for the final round, closing with an 8-under 64 to post 20-under and win by one. Scheffler winning back-to-back weeks as well on the PGA Tour. It is always a win when I'm sitting here on Golf Today with this man, Eamon Lynch. We're here with you for the next 2 hours, recapping the Players and also looking ahead to what's happening on the PGA Tour. And oh, by the way, yeah, there might be a little meeting going on between the Public Investment Fund and the PGA Tour player directors as well. Before we get into that, what made this Players so special on Sunday?
Wasn't that exactly what, it's not just what the PGA Tour needed, it's what fans needed, it's what the game at large needed, was the absolute best in a slugfest against each other at an iconic golf course, including a couple of our reigning major champions, the undisputed world number one. And it was drama right down to the very last stroke of the tournament. I mean, that couldn't have gotten any more agonizing on the last stroke of that tournament, particularly for Wyndham Clark. And it was just refreshing to have a week where no one was talking about money. And Scottie Scheffler picked up his $4.5 million check from a $25 million purse. It looked as though nobody cared about money for most of the week. Well, those guys, doesn't really matter so much, but it wasn't part of the narrative because suddenly we're playing a tournament where the trophy meant a lot more to those guys than the check ever would.
And you look at the caliber of champions over the years at the Players, or even just for the last decade. Scottie Scheffler, two in a row. Cam Smith, who's a major champion. Justin Thomas, Rory McIlroy, Webb Simpson, on down the list. Martin Keimer, Jason Day, Tiger Woods. I mean, all these guys have either won majors or competed on the game's biggest stage. You can sprinkle in Ricky Fowler and that heroic performance he had and Siwoo Kim. But it seems like every year we either get a champion that is a caliber of class in the upper echelon, or the drama down the stretch in the theater that 16, 17, and 18 are able to produce might be one of my favorite finishing stretches that we see year in and year out on the PGA Tour. It's just such a perfect symphony of holes, with the par 5 16th that you can reach into, the pending drama, potential car crash on 17, and then 18, you just have to hit such a good tee shot to find that fairway to avoid giving away the tournament on the 72nd hole.
And how refreshing is it that for a change this year, the Monday drama that spills a day beyond the tournament isn't actually weather-related? Because, of course, we're flight tracking for various private jets on the way to the Bahamas today, where there is a meeting between the PGA Tour's player directors and representatives of the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia as they attempt to break the ice and figure out what they're going to do in the future of this game.
I think if we're going to have any substantive agreement reached, I mean, this is a step that needs to be taken. And it's surprising to me that from June of last year, when we were sitting on this set on June 6th talking about the potential merger or agreement between the Public Investment Fund and the PGA Tour, that it's now taken 9 months for there to be a face-to-face with PIF Chief Governor Yasser Al-Rumayyan and other entities or other people involved with the Public Investment Fund to meet with player directors and say, okay, here are our motives. Here's how we want to try and reach some type of agreement. We'll be hitting on that throughout the show. So Scheffler, not surprisingly, the Tiger Woods guy, yeah, he came up in Scottie's press conference.
Obviously, like a lot of younger players, your generation, guys idolized Tiger, which you've spoke about before. Was there any part of you when you maybe were trying to dream of what you're doing right now that thought about being as dominant as Tiger was? I know, obviously, he's won a lot more, but you're on a path right now of, you know, the results are dominant. And I'm just kind of curious if you feel that way, a little bit off what Fergie was saying.
You know, I think that's a funny question. I'm not going to remember the exact numbers, but, like, we're playing at Riv this year, and I hit my tee ball, and this guy yells out, like, congrats on being number one, Scottie. You know, 11 more years to go. 11 more years to go. Anytime you can be compared to Tiger, I think is really special. But, I mean, the guy stands alone, I think, in our game. I mean, he really does. I mean, this is my 8th tournament win now out here. I've tied him in Players' Championships. Outside of that, you know, I got 14 more majors and, you know, 70-something PGA Tour events to catch up. So I think I'm going to stick to my routine and just continue to, you know, plod along, try and stay as even-keeled as I can.
Well, when you're playing golf at his level, the comparison is inevitable. Let's compare Tiger Woods 2001 versus Scottie Scheffler. At the Arnold Palmer Invitational, Tiger won at 15 under. Scottie did the same. At the Players, Tiger came back from 6 shots back halfway through to win. Scottie Scheffler did the same. At the Masters, Tiger won his second title. Scottie Scheffler, a chance to win his second title a month from now in Augusta, Georgia. And George, these comparisons, we're hearing them a lot more. You're hearing them thick and fast, particularly in the statistical realm in terms of what Scottie Scheffler does tee to green. Now in the record that's being compiled, is it a fair comparison?
I love how our stats team is able to cook up that graphic and see. You can find a little moment in time where Scottie could look like Tiger Woods. If I'm going to start the conversation, is it fair? No. Tiger's the heavyweight in our game, played the game at the highest level we've ever seen. Jack's the most accomplished champion. But Tiger at 27 had 34 PGA Tour wins, 8 majors. Scottie, 27 years old, has 8 wins and 1 major. So if you put anyone's career resume against Tiger, especially up until his early 30s, then the player B looks like some insignificant speck that you're just flicking away. But I'll quickly give you the case for and the case against. The case for, Scottie becomes the first guy to win back-to-back Players. His strokes gained last year, tee to green, were the best on the PGA Tour since 2006, Tiger Woods, and he's exceeding that this year. So Scottie looks like he has the staying power to potentially be in this run of greatness that could extend for a more prolonged period than we've seen with other guys. And that's what players, are, you hear his peers talk about him so glowingly. Max Homa, they're speaking about Scottie's game, tee to green, and his ball striking the same manner in which they would describe Tiger Woods. The case against is that most guys have a 3-year run of greatness. Rory McIlroy won all 3 of his majors from 2011 to 2014. Jordan Spieth had 10 of his 13 PGA Tour wins from 2015 to 17. Justin Thomas had 11 of his 15 from 2017 to 2020. Usually guys get hot for a 2 to 3 year run, and we are prisoners of the moment because we see these guys have this amazing run and we extrapolate, okay, they're going to continue doing that for 8, 10, 12 years down the road. Like if we saw Rory McIlroy in 2014, you'd say he's going to win 10, 12 majors. You think time is going to continue moving in the same direction. Life happens. Injuries happen. Families happen. Loss of form happens. For a lot of these guys, it's just hard to sustain it beyond that. And for Scottie Scheffler, he's basically Mr. Spring. If Reggie Jackson was Mr. October in baseball, Scottie Scheffler has all 8 of his wins from February 12th to April 10th on the calendar. They've all come in the early part of the season, and we haven't seen Scottie maintain that beyond the Masters. He's never won a tournament on a PGA Tour schedule that fell after the Masters. So with Scottie, and you look at how his wins are dispersed, 2 in February, 5 in the month of March. I mean, he should be Mr. Spring Break, basically, because he feasts in the month of March. And, of course, he won the Masters. So for Scottie to really get an accurate Tiger comparison, I think he needs to have a season. Like 2 years ago, you could say, okay, he had 4 wins and a major PGA Tour Player of the Year. But I would say a 5 or 6 win season where he really separates him, like we're seeing in the world golf rankings, where he has a 4.4 margin right now. It's the largest gap between 1 and 2 in about 7 years. Mm-hmm. But I think you really need to see that where it's like, okay, this is a Tiger-type season. What do you think?
He's not Tiger, but then again, what matters is that nobody else is Scottie Scheffler either. I guess everyone's within their same window or their same era, and you judge them against the competition they have. What is remarkable to me is how unfazed he is by all of it. There is no noise around him. And some of the guys that you mentioned, Rory McIlroy, Jordan Spieth, Justin Thomas, and particularly Tiger, there was always a degree of noise around them. A lot of it was invited, but they were more kind of theatrical performers. Scotty Scheffler just lives in his old world. Social media isn't there. He talked about how even he spends his time on the Apple News app, and if it's a golf story, he just clicks, not for me, not for me, not for
me. I love that. I love to hear that.
No one is getting into Scotty Scheffler's headspace. And when you consider what he's managed to accomplish over the last year or two with a putter that was, at best, suboptimal, considering the rest of his game. In fact, it was suboptimal even by the averages on the PGA Tour. And Rory McIlroy deserves the blame for this because he told him switch to a mallet putter a few weeks ago. He's going to regret that because I do think this could be one of those years where Scotty Scheffler does kind of go on a run because he was fifth in putting at Bay Hill. An extraordinary performance given his recent numbers with that club. He was 37th in the field of the 71 guys who made the cut at the Players' Championship. Very much middle of the pack.
Yeah.
Middle of the pack is good enough for Scotty Scheffler to win any week out there. And you can build a hell of a career by not winning in Q1. Johnny Miller won 25 times on tour, and a little over half a dozen of them came any other time of the year apart from Q1. Well, but I do expect more of him.
And Miller had that three-year run of 73 to 76, which, and Nick Price, another guy who had won three majors in a couple-year arc. For Scotty Scheffler, we see maybe four or five guys on tour are the ones where they're in contention and it's flipped the channel. It becomes appointment viewing, must-see TV. I mean, Tiger, although we're the hourglass is going the wrong direction with Tiger, but I'd say Jordan Spieth, Rory McIlroy, Phil Mickelson at the Masters last year. What does Scotty need to do where he starts reaching that upper echelon of player where the average sports fan thinks, this is a moment that I need to help capture too?
It has to be performance related with Scotty because he's so laid back. He's so low key. He's not a fist pumper. He's not a theatrical guy at all. So he's not going to be a polarizing character where fans might tune in to see him win or see him lose in the nature of sports fandom. It's got to be performance related. And he's so low key, I actually honestly think he'd have to win the first couple of legs of the Grand Slam so that we get to Pinehurst and suddenly people are thinking this could be a season for all the ages right here. Because Scotty's just going about his business. But it is interesting when you see other players talk about him. And they are intimidated by Scotty Scheffler, but they're not intimidated by the aura or the personality in the way, say, Tiger or Brooks Koepka intimidated people. He intimidates them with numbers. I mean, he's number one strokes gained off the tee, number one strokes gained approach, number one strokes gained total, number one strokes gained tee to green, number one in birdie average, number one in scoring average. They all know exactly what he's going to do and how he's going to do it. And I think that's unnerving for these guys out there. And if he finds that putter on top of everything else he's doing tee to green, a lot of these guys are going to start thinking that they are playing for second place.
Speaking of playing for second place, it's amazing how razor thin the margin is to win on the PGA Tour. We had three guys who were T2. How different the narrative would be if that putt fell for Wyndham Clark. And if Clark had forced a playoff and had somehow come back, then it would have been his second win this season on the PGA Tour. And we'd be anointing the reigning U.S. Open champ as the next guy who could potentially threaten to be maybe world number one. Somehow, the cruelest of lip outs you'd ever see on the 72nd hole. Here's Clark's reaction to what unfolded.
I don't know how that putt doesn't go in. It was kind of right center with, I feel like, a foot to go, and I knew it was going to keep breaking, but it had speed, and thought I was going to go inside left, and then even when it kind of seemed to lip, I thought it would lip in. So, I mean, I'm pretty gutted it didn't go in.
Not the result you wanted, obviously, but what positives will you walk away with?
I just played back-to-back weeks on two pretty challenging golf courses that I traditionally haven't done very well on, and just went second and second, so... I'll take those positives. I played awesome in both weeks. And I'll also take that I can play in the moment, in any moment, against the best players in the world on the best golf courses. I mean, I almost birdied the last three at one of the most iconic golf courses. So, maybe next week sometime I'll really be able to look at those positives and feel good about it. But right now I'm pretty down.
You guys lose a lot more than you win in this game, but the way that this happened on the 72nd hole, how does it compare to some of the other feelings you've had walking off the golf course with close calls?
obviously there's positives in it. You finish second, you get a bunch of points and money and all that stuff, but it just sucks. I mean, I've always wanted and dreamt about making a putt that really mattered to either force a playoff or win a tournament, and it's I've yet to do it in my professional career, so I was pretty bummed that I didn't have one of those really awesome moments. So, but yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm still a little beside myself. I'm shocked. I'm just so shocked that putt didn't go in.
What's this do for you heading into major season? These two performances, you seem like you were really into it today. I mean, getting fired up pretty much the whole round.
Yeah. I'm really hoping that, these 2 seconds are just leading to something greater. So I'm, I believe that. And, I hope that maybe these shortcomings in these last couple weeks, lead to something greater. So I'm really looking forward to what's ahead.
Terrific run of form lately for Wyndham Clark, starting with that win at the AT&T Pebble Beach, which was called after 54 holes due to weather. Didn't have his best Phoenix or LA, but look at those last 2 weeks. The Arnold Palmer Invitational, second to Scotty Scheffler. And then yesterday, that agonizing second to Scotty Scheffler. And Scotty Scheffler hadn't actually seen that final putt lip out until he joined the live from set last night and watched it in person.
Have you seen Wyndham's putt yet?
I have not seen Wyndham's putt.
We're going to show it to you. I mean, this is absolutely nuts. 17 feet to tie and go to a playoff.
Oof. It's tough. That hole. It's a tough finishing hole. And, I mean, Wyndham put up a good fight. He put up a good fight last week. He's been playing, obviously, some great golf this year. And, I'm sure this won't be the last time this year that we're both on top of the leaderboard battling it out.
I think by the time we get to the end of the year, George, we will have watched that putt hundreds of times. That is going to be one of the most memorable shots of the year for a guy who didn't leave with the trophy.
Like Scotty's reaction, oof, that's tough. But he wasn't exactly shedding a tear for Wyndham Clark. And it felt like one of those tournaments down the stretch where once Scotty posted 20, and so many times we had seen it with Tiger, where he would be at a number, and then guys just couldn't quite get there. And we had three guys who had an opportunity on the 18th. Wyndham Clark came the closest. His arc the last year has been incredible. He left the Players. He was 109th in the world last year, still looking for his first win on the PGA Tour, was questioning if he could ever win on the PGA Tour. Now he's all the way up to fourth in the world. And form-wise, if you looked at the last, call it, 2 months, I mean, you probably put him two behind Scotty Scheffler, maybe ahead of Rory McIlroy right now, but a good Rory week could flip that pretty quick. But Wyndham's playing as good as anyone not named Scotty Scheffler right now on the PGA Tour, and he seems to find an inner resolve when the stakes are the highest, and we're seeing his best form in the biggest events.
Striking how Harmon, Schauffele, and Clark did not make big mistakes. There were minor little mistakes, but minor mistakes are all you have to make with Scotty Scheffler is being Scotty Scheffler. Coming up, we're going to have more on Scheffler's victory at TPC Sawgrass. We also have some aviation news today. We've been tracking private jets this morning on their way to the Bahamas. The long-awaited face-to-face between the PGA Tour's player directors and representatives of Saudi Arabia's Public Investment Fund. We're going to have more on that closely guarded meeting with Rex Hoggard and Ryan Lavner after the break. Well, it's time now for a Golf Today roundtable as we welcome in our favourite Muppets, Waldorf and Statler of Golf Channel, Rex Hoggard and Ryan Lavner, who are out on site all week. Rex, I want to start with you. Are we at dominant number one status now? We've had this debate this morning, George and I, that there's still a ways to go. But in terms of the competition that he's got right now, forget measuring him against Tiger. Is Scotty Scheffler truly a dominant number one?
I think if you look at the math, the world ranking math, he's leading now by 4.5 average world ranking points. And you're right, that doesn't compare to Tiger Woods in his prime, doesn't even come close to that. But I think it compares well to what DJ did when he was playing his best golf, or Rory McIlroy did when he was playing his best golf. And I think George touched on it in the last segment. Relative to the rest of the field, yes, he is dominant. And I know you look at last season and how he finished up essentially after the spring when he made all his hay. It's not as though he was missing cuts. It's not as though he was finishing tied for 55th. It was top 10 every week, week in and week out. Now we end up here where he has done it in back-to-back weeks, where he's found a way to putt not great, but average. And if he just putts average, he is going to be a dominant player. So what we've seen this fortnight absolutely adds up to a dominant player.
And Rex, I mean, touching on what you just shared as far as where that gap is right now between Scottie Scheffler at world number one and Rory McIlroy at world number two, largest gap since Dustin Johnson, and that was 7 years ago. Scottie in week 43 of being world number one, DJ had a 64-week run, and then the next largest gap was Rory McIlroy in 2015. He went for 54 weeks. You see a lot of these guys who have 3-4 year run of greatness, and then they fall back a gear. With Scottie Scheffler, we see what he just did. He's world number one right now. We want to say he can do this for the next decade. How much staying power do you think he's going to have?
I think it's a lot, and I heard you guys in the opening segment, and I think a lot obviously depends on whether he can stay healthy. Scottie Scheffler has made a concerted effort over the past couple years, not to necessarily get bigger in the gym or stronger in the gym, but really to maintain his flexibility. He was really plagued by some back issues in college that kind of derailed some of the momentum he had as a junior player. I mean, he's one of the best junior players in U.S. history. And so that has always kind of been front of mind with Scottie Scheffler, maintaining flexibility, making sure he's doing the right things, because the consistency that he has on a week in, week out basis, it does take a toll on his body, and I think he's done a really good job about that. I think the thing about Scottie Scheffler right now that Rex just touched on is that there's kind of like a inevitability to Scottie Scheffler. There's almost an infallibility when it comes to Scottie Scheffler as well. All you needed to do was listen to his peers on Sunday, whether it was Xander Schauffele or Wyndham Clark saying, you know, quote, of course Scottie Scheffler was going to be in the mix, because that's what he does as the best player in the world. That's now 27 consecutive under par rounds. And I think, you know, regardless of what the rankings say currently, regardless of how big the gap is between Scottie as world number one and Rory McIlroy as world number two, I think all of his peers now know that in order to win the golf tournament, they're going to have to beat Scottie Scheffler. And that appears to be an increasingly difficult task.
And the size of that gap is obviously growing. The gap between Scottie Scheffler and Rory is the same gap as Rory to number 19 in the rankings. And Sam Burns, Ryan, you were out there with that final group yesterday. What does Xander Schauffele take away from this? We haven't really talked about him much today. It's another near miss, which you might think would be a negative for him, but he's also pretty early in this working relationship with Chris Como. And if you're getting this close to a big championship, that's got to be considered a positive. What do you think his reaction or mindset is today?
Yeah, I think the early returns certainly have to be positive in his work right now with Chris Como. I mean, this was still Xander Schauffele's tournament to win with 8 holes to go. Obviously did not birdie 11. Missed his mark by just a couple of feet on 14. Made bogey there on 15. That was a ball that he probably gets up and down, he said, more than half of the time. And then on 17, I'm sure he would like that read or at least that stroke back from 6 feet on 17, which cost him a much-needed birdie there. But, you know, Xander, I think, has now has 5 top 10s. It's the second most on tour this season. And the progress that they're making, he has full trust in Chris Como. Essentially, they're trying to get him to a place where he's from an above-average driver of the golf ball to an elite driver of the golf ball. That's kind of the target range where he's trying to get into the low to mid 180s average ball speed, where if he couples that with the trajectory that he hits, he's going to experience a distinct advantage just by able to fly bunkers or cut corners. He has full trust in what Chris Como's doing, and I don't think there's anything over these past couple months that should dissuade him from thinking that eventually he's going to knock down that door more consistently and not be the player who I think golf fans are a little bit frustrated with, where he's so talented, he has no weaknesses in his game, and yet he still can't quite snag that significant title.
Rex, with Wyndham Clark, how should we label him after the run the last couple weeks, finishing back-to-back? Is he a big game hunter officially, or are we going to go with a different moniker?
I would label him angry after last night. He was certainly the guy who left property probably with the biggest chip on his shoulder based on just what he said afterwards. And, yes, I think big game hunter is also a fair comparison on this. I mean, you don't finish back-to-back at Bay Hill and then TPC Sawgrass. To Scottie Scheffler, and not have what it takes to win on the PGA Tour. The putt on 18, it was heartbreaking. It was the height of theater. And I think he's probably going to need a day or two to sort of unwind and take a deep breath and then realize that everything he's doing is right. That, as Eamon pointed out, you don't have to make big mistakes at TPC Sawgrass. You don't have to make big mistakes when you're going head-to-head with the world number one to lose a golf tournament. He wasn't going to give it away. So I think what he's seen so far this season, winning at Pebble Beach, finishing with a final round 60 there, coming up just short last week at Bay Hill, coming up just short at TPC Sawgrass. Yeah, he's mad, but I think as he gets further and further down the road from this, he's only going to take positives.
Rex, we've seen a lot of the same things from Rory McIlroy this year in the sense that every time he talks after a round to the media, there are comments that make news. And what we're seeing inside the ropes is far short of his best. This T19 finish at Sawgrass, his first top 20 on the PGA Tour this year. Does he need to be a little bit more like Scottie Scheffler and kind of tune out the noise and focus on his business?
I think he probably would like to be, but I don't think it's in his nature. I go back to a couple of years ago when Jordan Spieth had just come out on tour, and we kind of all gravitated to him for a lot of different reasons, the way he played the game, the way he was winning, and really the way he engaged with the media. He didn't hold anything back. There was really no secrets. He was an open book. And I remember him saying at one point, I feel like I need to start saying less. And as we've seen years now have gone by since he made that comment, he didn't, because it's not in his nature. And I think when Rory, it's not in his nature not to answer questions honestly, like he did on Sunday at TPC Sawgrass. And quite frankly, I think he wanted to send a message when he was asked specifically about the meeting between the player directors and representatives from Saudi Arabia's public investment fund today. I think having met with Yasser Al-Rumayyan, the governor of the public investment fund himself, he knows what the message is going to be. And I think he views this as a very positive step.
Of course, the less Rory says, the less we actually have to talk about here, guys. And we have a lot more to kick around in this conversation. We're going to dig in on this meeting between the players and the Saudis that's going on right now in the Bahamas. We'll be right back with Rex and Ryan after this break. We're back on Golf Today, continuing our conversation here with George Savarikas, Ryan Lavner and Rex Hoggard. Rex, there's a lot of attention on the Bahamas today. We've been following private jets heading there for this meeting between player directors on the PGA Tour, some of the strategic sports group that invested recently in the PGA Tour, and representatives of the Saudi Arabian Public Investment Fund, which may or may not include Yasser Al-Rumayyan, the governor of that fund. As you know, Rex, there's a distinct faction of at least three players on the PGA Tour board who have been somewhat sceptical of a deal with the Saudis. Some of it might just be bruised feelings from the June 6th framework agreement. Do you think they're getting any closer to the point where they are willing to move on this? Or do you think they're going to accept that there's some kind of inevitability about this money coming into the game?
I think if you do listen to the other side, they probably make it sound like it's going to be inevitable. Certainly when you look at this meeting, and Adam Scott probably said it best when we asked him what his expectations were going into this meeting. He said it was just basically a chance to put a face to a name and an opportunity to hear exactly why the public investment fund wants to be involved with golf. Rory McIlroy was asked about this yesterday and he boiled it down. It's as simple as this. They're a wealth fund and they want to be able to quote unquote park their money in a business that's safe and creative and has a good future and has growth. And that's certainly the way they look at the PGA Tour. Now, changing those players' minds on the policy board is probably going to be a little bit more difficult than just having coffee with representatives from the public investment fund. There are some, as you know, very entrenched feelings, and I think it's going to take a long time for them to come around on some of these things based on what's transpired over the last 2.5 years, but this is a start.
And Rex, it was so interesting, wasn't it, talking to Adam Scott or Patrick Cantlay or Webb Simpson, how tight-lipped they were about the meeting, details of the meeting, what they wanted to hear. I thought Patrick Cantlay said it best when he said he's planning on doing more listening than talking at this point. Adam Scott said he basically just wants to see what members of the PIF's intentions are. Maybe they're not tipping their hand intentionally in what they think, but it's pretty clear that they don't share the eagerness that perhaps Rory McIlroy does, who obviously sat on the PGA Tour policy board before removing himself late last year. I think it's best for the players if they are still operating from the position that PGA Tour Commissioner Jay Monahan laid out last Tuesday when he met with the media here, when he said that a deal with the PIF is still in the best interest of the PGA Tour, and that's the best eventual outcome of the PGA Tour. As long as the PGA Tour Player Board is operating from that premise as well, I think there's reasons for optimism here.
Guys, was also fascinated by Rory McIlroy's comments, and he was trying to delineate who did the disservice for the public investment fund, and he put the onus of the blame on LIV Golf and Greg Norman, trying to separate the two. Lav, who do you think has done the bigger, quote, disservice? PGA Tour Commissioner Jay Monahan or the actions of Greg Norman, LIV Golf, et cetera?
Well, I think there's probably some shared blame here, doesn't it? I mean, the PGA Tour product has probably gone stale, and there was obviously an open invitation for some sort of disruptor, and I think Greg Norman has certainly seized that opportunity and disrupted all he has. I found Rory's comments very interesting, basically saying that PIF is one entity and LIV is kind of doing its own, and yet it was Yasser Al-Rumayyan and members of the PIF that were extending the $300 million offer to Jon Rahm late last year that blew the gap even wider between these two sides. And so I thought that was an interesting point for him to make. I certainly think there's equal blame here. Pinning it all on Greg Norman is probably not fair. And as we've seen players in the PGA Tour membership as well, there's still plenty of hard feelings as it relates to Jay Monahan and the job that he's done over the past couple of years.
It is interesting just watching this general debate, how it's now entirely become a matter of commerce. It always was for the players. I think it was among the fan base, perhaps there was the morality argument to it as well. Never was for the players. It clearly isn't for most people who are in this game at this stage. Rex, touching on Jay Monahan's press conference last week, he wasn't remotely expansive on any of the subjects that he discussed, but nor was he evasive in the sense that he actually said, I'm not going to discuss this, mainly the PIF negotiations, and here's why I'm not going to discuss it. What did you make of his performance? He at least seemed to register the fact that there's a weariness among the fans now in terms of the PGA Tour product and what the state of this game is right now.
I came away from that press conference with a great amount of empathy for the position Jay Monahan is in. And look, I understand you cannot negotiate a deal like this in public. And he was in an impossible situation. He knew the questions he was going to get asked, and he knew he couldn't answer any of them. If he did, it was probably going to lead to losing leverage or trying to gain leverage in a foolish play. And so he was in a position where he was honest. He was upfront. And to your point, the idea that he addressed the fan weariness, the idea that they're tired of hearing about money and lawsuits and mergers and potential deals. And I think we've seen that over the last few months. You look at the ratings 2 weeks ago at Bay Hill, they were down. And I think it has a lot to do with the idea that fans are tired of hearing about this. And the fact that Jay Monahan and the PGA Tour realize that along with this deal and along with getting the players on board with whatever becomes of the PGA Tour, they know their biggest challenge is probably going to be getting those fans back and getting them to understand that they are still the best product in the game.
Speaking of the fans, one last question I wanted to slide in here. And we saw Dylan Wu, who's been very active on social media the past few weeks, tweeting this after the players. And he was just touching on the exciting finish that we had. I don't know about you guys, probably one of the best finishes on tour this year is a full field event with 144 players and a cut. So, Lab, I want to position this to you. With so much of the discussion now being about what's in the best interest for the fans, have you heard any public sentiment that has been directed towards fans clamoring for limited fields and no-cut events?
I have not heard that personally, but that's not to say that it hasn't happened. I think there's probably a compromise in here, isn't there, George, where 70 is probably not the right number, and when you get to 144 at the Players' Championship, you can make the argument with the number of players who are ranked outside the top 200 in the world that field is probably watered down a little bit as well. 100 kind of seems like the sweet spot, and that's a number that's been broached by Rory and Wyndham Clark, among others. But I think Sunday at the Players' Championship was exactly what the PGA Tour has been pining for. It's investing in the fans. Even NBC was investing in the product, whether it was live from or some of the technology that we rolled out in the coverage there. I mean, that's what golf fans want to see. And that's why I think it's going to be so interesting to see what the ratings for this TV event were. Because if this did not resonate with golf fans, if the ratings were still down year over year, I think that's an indication that golf fans and the relationship with the PGA Tour could be irreparably broken. Because if this did not resonate and you had four of the top 10 players in the world in a Sunday slugfest at one of the most exciting stadiums in all of golf, I'm not sure what else you could possibly have. Would it have been enriched by Brooks Koepka's presence and John Rahm and Cam Smith and Dustin Johnson? Of course, I think that's inarguable. But the PGA Tour product as it exists right now, that's as good of a showcase as you could possibly get. And that was a combination of course, top players, and I think to your point, a deeper field as well.
Lab, 100%. And aside from the American Express with Nick Dunlap, the ratings have been down each and every week, including at Bay Hill, where it was about a 10% drop. So you would hope once we see those for the players that there's a course correction for not just last week, but going forward this season. You know what I'm pining for, guys? Of course, the podcast. So Rex and Lav, thanks for joining us. If you're in the market for more conversations like this, be sure to check out the podcast, which includes the best interviews from our show. While you're at it, take a listen to the Golf Channel podcast with Rex and Lav. There's the plug. Be sure to subscribe to the Golf Channel YouTube page as well.
Our colleague John Wood was on the ground for NBC all week and joins us now from an exotic location in Tampa, Florida. John, what did Ted Scott add to Scottie Scheffler? Because when you look at those results, I guess Scottie was always going to be successful. That was clear. What does Ted Scott bring to that partnership?
Ted's a good friend of mine, but Ted checks all the boxes as a caddy. He does a ton of homework. I saw him out there Tuesday night all by himself after Scottie had finished whatever practice he was doing, getting some run-out yardages, getting some carry yardages that weren't necessarily in the book. He's a tireless worker. He's a fun guy to be around. He's got great stories, and he's been in every situation, and I can't emphasize that enough. He's not going to be, you know, he's not going to shrink from any situation. He's been in Ryder Cups and won majors with Bubba, and so it's not like he's going to be in a situation where he's going to be timid or afraid to say what he needs to say, what he feels his truth is. And I think their personalities clicked right away. And it's just been a magical partnership for both of them.
John, I'm not going to break any news here. We both know that Scottie Scheffler is really, really good. He's the world number one back-to-back PGA Tour Player of the Year. We've seen him win the Players before, win a major, have a four-win season. Out of this week, was there any takeaway where you saw something from Scottie where you went, wow, okay, that's even another wrinkle that I hadn't seen before?
The injury is one thing. I think we all know that Scottie's tough. He's not going to back away from any situation physically or mentally. And I think the neck issue showed that. But I just think his continued good putting with that new putter is scary, frankly, for a lot of guys. It's getting to the point where if Scottie's got his A game, you know, there isn't another one who can win right now. He's that good at all aspects. So I think the fact that the putting continued, what he showed as the putter got increasingly better and at API at Bay Hill, it was good all week this week. And the injury is just another thing on top of it. Shows he can get it done multiple different ways, and he's not going to use excuses to slow him down.
On the subject of other guys getting worried, John, if you're the number two, Rory McIlroy, or the number four, Wyndham Clark, let's leave out number three in the middle, John Rahm, for right now. Are those guys waking up this morning feeling a little bit sobered up that how are they going to elevate their game to compete with a guy who only has to be middle of the pack on the greens to excel?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's I don't think it's necessarily going to change the way they've been preparing. I think they are probably preparing the best way they know how. But it may add a little resilience to it. It may add a little bit, I need to do more to catch this guy, because right now he is obviously the best player in the world. It's not really close right now. So I think when it's close, you know, and you're getting beat here or there by him and beating him a few times, then you're on the right path. But I think a lot of guys who are right there with Scottie in that top five, top 10, are looking at it right now going, all right, I need to change something about what I'm doing to get closer to this guy.
You know, we've talked a lot about John Rahm this year not being on the PGA Tour. The narrative last year was very much Scottie Scheffler, John Rahm dominating the first quarter of the year. There was some sentiment early in the week that this is a tournament unlike the majors where the live guys can't and won't be competing. John Rahm's not there. Brooks Koepka's not there. Was it diminished by the fact that they weren't there as good as it was?
Not for me. Not for me, it wasn't. Once you get, I think the PGA Tour still has so many of the top players. And as a whole, when you get those, you know, big fields, you know, it showed. They all came up to the top, all the big guys. You know, you had four out of the top 12, I think, coming down the stretch yesterday. And I'm sure if you're on Liv's side, you're going to say it was diminished. But for my eyes, no. And nothing could have made that tournament much better than it was. It was just you had big names out in front. You had the number one player trailing, playing an incredible round. I never thought one second about anybody from Liv yesterday during that telecast. I just thought it was that good. Now, would I have liked to have them there? Yes. I think I would love to see everybody playing together again. But I don't think it took anything away from that great championship yesterday.
John, you could flip a coin for your takeaway with Xander Schauffele. Once again, he's putting himself in that spot in the final group in a big event, or it's more scar tissue buildup, once again, coming up short in a big event. The concern level that he hasn't gotten to the finish line in these going forward, do you think that's going to linger with him?
That's a great question, and I don't think so, and here's why. I watched him yesterday. And other than that one little stretch on 14-15, he did everything he needed to do to win that golf tournament. Just the best player in the world did the best player in the world things to beat him. I didn't think Xander lost that yesterday. I think he got beat. And the way I just watched Xander all weekend, he didn't look like he was going to back up. He didn't look like he had any backup in him. He looked like, okay, I know where I am. I know who I am right now, and I'm just going to play my game, and I think it's going to be best to win. And it was darn close, you know, without Scotty doing what he did. You know, we're in a playoff yesterday. So I think it was, you know, he didn't get the win, which obviously he dearly wanted, but I think this was a different Xander yesterday. And I think he knows he's okay in those situations. And that was just a freak occurrence of the best player in the world.
We did see a lot of the best players in the world, a lot of the top ranked guys show up for work yesterday and put on a great show. But was there anyone this week, John, that you were surprised that they were kind of a no-show in the tournament that you expected more from?
Yeah, I mean, I think the obvious one would be JT. I think JT has been trending very good, I mean, very upward this year. And it's a course he'd won on. And I really felt like his game was peaking at the right time. And maybe it still is in a few weeks at Augusta. We'll see. I still think his game is on the upswing. I was a little surprised that he didn't play better this week. Max Homa, I kind of had some good thoughts about Max Homa as well. And he got off to that really good start on Thursday and didn't really follow it up after that. But there's always going to be big names who don't necessarily have, you know, have the tournaments you think they're going to have. But I would say JT and Max Homa were the two for me that stood out.
John, where do you rank the finish on Sunday among best PGA Tour events we've seen so far this season?
This season, I think it was the best. I mean, you had so many big names with a chance to win with three holes to play. And then, you know, even guys like, you know, Wyndham Clark, who almost felt like he played himself out of it mid-round, came back with birdies on 16 and 17 and a birdie and a half, let's say, on 18, because I still don't know how that putt didn't go down. We could still be out there in a playoff. But it was the best finish to me. Just back to who won and who was up there and how he did it was just phenomenal.
Wyndham Clark looks like he can be a serious problem come major season, and looking forward to whenever the third fight is between him and Scottie Scheffler, because Scottie got him the first two cracks at it. John Wood, thanks for hopping on with us.
Thank you, guys. Enjoyed it, as always.
Before we get to break, let's take a look at that Comcast Business Tour Top 10. Eamon, wild guess, who do you think might be number one now?
Oh, well, this is no surprise.
Oh, Scottie Scheffler, the world number one, who's won two straight weeks, is one. Wyndham Clark, number two. Hideki Matsuyama is three. And Schauffele, with a big jump, moves up five spots to fourth. And Brian Harman moves up 23 spots. So he is currently among the top 10. Now let's welcome in our colleague with NBC Golf, eight-time PGA Tour winner Brad Faxton joining us. Brad, 49 years, we'd never seen a back-to-back winner at the Players. So why was Scottie Scheffler the one to break through?
Well, it's interesting to me in his interviews is I think he may have been the first one or the last one to hear that he was a back-to-back winner. I don't think he pays much attention to what's around him and to his benefit and to his credit. I don't think he's a real history buff for the game. I think he tries to stay away. We know he stays away from social media. But just the fact that he's not paying attention to noise, I think, is a big plus for his game. And what we've seen with Scotty, not only last week at the Players, but the week before at API, when he combines his tee to green, which has been outstanding for several years now, with extraordinary putting, he's going to be a force for a long, long time.
Brad, were you surprised that the putting stroke that he just developed with Phil Kenyon quite recently held up as well as it did under pressure? I know you pay a lot of attention to exactly what guys are working on the greens. What exactly has Scottie Scheffler changed to get from where he was to what he is?
Well, the one obvious is the actual putter itself. He's gone through a couple different putters, from the blade Scottie Cameron that he used. Then he went to another different blade, different company, and then to this mallet, some kind of version of a spider with a different neck. He talked in detail about how he took the line off the ball. But I thought the biggest difference to me when I was watching him the last few weeks is the extra half an inch seemed to me to raise him up just a little bit, and where his arms got a little straighter, he was a little bit more upright. And to me, that looked like a better balance in his posture, where it looked to me before the previous weeks, if you had nudged him from the backside and pushed him over, he might have fallen over on his toes. And that might not seem that big a deal, but when you get into the battle, into the heat, you know, you're in your fourth day in a row of playing, and there might be some kind of a physical toll on a person for that long, I think the posture can be a big part of it. And his stroke looked absolutely flawless. And I even made a call yesterday, I think it was on the 13th hole, as he was going to knock in a, I don't know, 4 or 5 footer. I'm sorry, it wasn't. It was the 11th hole. I knew he was going to make this putt before he hit it. It was a putt from that distance, from 4 feet. It was on 11. I knew he was going to make it before he hit it, and I think he had that same feeling. I think it's a giant transformation that really all the work he and Kenyon did was finally starting to pay off.
Brad, we're having a little deja vu with Scottie Scheffler. Last year at this point, he had 2 wins, including the Players, at this part of the schedule. Now he's in the same spot. We have seen Scottie Scheffler put together a magical season just 2 years ago in 2022 when he had 4 wins right. and a major. What would he need to do this year in the modern era for you to call it a truly dominant season?
Well, he's been the dominant player the last 3 seasons now. And what's remarkable to me is the Players were so, you know, envious or impressed by the fact that even though he wasn't putting well, his statistics were poor during this great stretch and maybe sporadic. But now that he's combined some superb putting with his ball striking that's Tiger-esque, I don't see how you really stop this guy. I don't think he goes home and really thinks too much about the fact that he's just won 2 tournaments or he's taken a more commanding lead on number one player in the world. I think he just goes about day to day. Like he said, if he hadn't won at the API, it wouldn't have changed his Monday, you know, just the amount of texts he might get on his phone. And I don't think a lot of players in the game today can say the same thing.
We haven't seen Scottie's best golf in May, June, and July compared to the dominant Scottie we see February, March, and April. Why do you think that's been the case?
I think that's a good point, and I would say that for a lot of golfers, a lot of PGA Tour players, when you win, particularly when you win early in your career, a lot of times that can be an obstacle going forward. Your expectations get high. You get pulled in a lot of different directions, maybe corporately, opportunities to go play elsewhere around the world. Scottie doesn't seem to have that in his life. It's kind of mysterious why he hasn't played up to his same level after April. But I remember asking Jack Nicklaus once, I was playing in the Masters after winning in New Orleans, and I missed the cut. And I said, Jack, I need to play better after winning a tournament. He says, join the club. And I go, join the club? You won 82 times. You had so many chances. He said, defending a championship is hard. You get all this attention taken away. And I just think this is one of those building blocks for Scottie where there's no way, you know, going forward, I see him not playing well after the month of April, after the Masters, and where he wouldn't contend every week he plays.
So we've got a dominant number one, Brad. What do you make of number two, Rory McIlroy, right now? He won early in the year. to start a season in Dubai. This was his first top 20 finish in five PGA Tour starts this year, and even that was just a T19. Does it all seem a bit sloppy to you right now?
Yeah, it just shows the fickleness of this game in a way, because when he played at the Cognizant down here at the PGA National, which is a tough driving course, and then at Bay Hill, he was number one off the tee. He found something with that lower tee height, and it seemed like he was driving it just as far and hitting it fairly straight, and then lost a little bit of his iron game at Bay Hill and came to the Players as a guy that, hey, you have to watch out for him. He's making some birdies. He putted superbly the last 3 days at Bay Hill. And as the irons got a little bit better, as he worked very hard early in the week, really on his own with Harry Diamond and his own track man, the driver kind of went awry. And, you know, when you're off just a little bit at TPC Sawgrass, a lot of things can go funny. It can affect your confidence. And even for the best players in the world, something like that happens. And I know it's bothering Rory. I know he wants to figure this out so that he can make this great run up to the Masters like he's planning. So he's got, you know, a couple of weeks off to work on his game, work on his swing. He's going to go play the Valero Open before he goes to play at the Masters, which is a new strategy that I think is a good strategy for Rory.
Facts, I guess being off just a little bit wasn't necessarily unique to Rory McIlroy at the Players. You could say that for Wyndham Clark for a good chunk of the final round. Misses that short eagle putt on the second. Another short par putt miss on the 10th. What did he show you those last three holes coming up just short in defeat?
There was some incredible golf. And I have to say, finally, NBC got a very compelling tournament or championship to watch down the stretch in the last five events that we've done. And Scottie Scheffler knew he had to shoot a very low score to catch those guys. And I know Brandel did a beautiful piece on Live From about how difficult it is to hold the lead there at TPC Sawgrass. And, you know, both, you know, Schauffele had a lot to prove, hadn't won in a couple of years, needs a big title like this. And what I really call the fifth major, I heard that phrase thrown around a lot. And I think that'd be a good name for the Players Championship, the fifth major, because of the strength of the field and the golf tournament being the same week every year in March. Wyndham Clark struggled with his putter. Schauffele struggled with his putter, both not being as positive with the putter and the speed that they were hitting putts. And down at the very end, when they were finally having to chase the lead rather than hold on to the lead, it seemed like their mindset changed a little bit. Both hit incredible iron shots into the par 5 16. Both left those putts short. Both fired it closely. The two best shots of a twosome we saw all day at the very fickle 17th, which was the hardest golf course on the course on Sunday. And, you know, Clark made a good putt there. It was incredible to watch. You know, I think Schauffele hit a pretty good tee shot that ran through the fairway on 18 with some surprise with that adrenaline. And that poor lip out for Clark, it was hard to deal with because he did everything he needed to do on 18 to give a chance. But for Scottie Scheffler sitting on that practice range, dodging three bullets in a row with Harmon having the chance as well, was very, very dramatic.
You said, Brad, it was a compelling finish on Sunday. There's still some compelling news on Monday. We've learned that PGA Tour player directors are in the Bahamas with John Henry, who you know from the Fenway Sports Group, and potentially representatives of the Saudi Arabian Public Investment Fund. Do you sense there's a lot of interest or trepidation among the rank-and-file members at what might come out of this meeting, for better or worse, in their mind?
Yeah, I'm sure, depending on what side of the fence you're on, there's a lot of players trying to figure out what's going to happen. I listened to Rory's comments in his presser last night, talking about the complexities of all this. You know, SSG, John Henry going down there, probably with a few members of his team, are trying to convince Liv, Piff, Yasser, all those guys, how do we get this together at a faster rate? I know there's contracts with the Liv players going out to 2029 or 30, and I think there's players, you saw, probably heard Lucas Glover's comments about how he doesn't like these smaller, stronger fields. You know, from a spectator's point of view or a broadcaster's point of view, I mean, watching these signature events with bigger names is really kind of fun to call and fun to watch. But at the same time, there has to be a pathways forward for the players that are out of that top 70. And I know there are with the Aon different ways you can get on there and playing well in the non-signature events. There's just a lot that needs to be done and needs to be done quickly. And I think, Eamon, the two biggest issues are the players that stayed with the PGA Tour, particularly the policy board members like Patrick Cantlay and Jordan Spieth. If the LIV players are allowed back to play on the PGA Tour, is there going to be a cost to that? How is that going to be managed? And I think that's a huge issue going forward, never mind all the government regulations with the SEC that the PGA Tour has to deal with.
Definitely something to track in the future as far as what the unwind process would look like going forward. Rory had some additional comments in which he said that he felt that Greg Norman and LIV kind of did a disservice to what the public investment fund's true aims are when it comes to the game of golf longer term. Can you really separate those two when it comes to these negotiations, Fax?
Well, I think that's why we all love to listen to Rory McIlroy, is every time he gets a microphone in front of him, he says something. And there was a huge pause before he said what you just said to me about the selection of Greg Norman for their CEO. He was always a divisive player on the PGA Tour, particularly after his try back in 1994 to create a world tour back then without the support of the PGA Tour or Arnold Palmer or Jack Nicklaus. So Rory's probably correct in that. I know that all the players are on the LIV Tour would be sitting watching that Players Championship going, why can I not play in that? And I think they're missing what the brand, the PGA Tour, brings worldwide now in the best competitions in the world at some of the most memorable golf courses.
On that point, Brad, there was some sentiment earlier in the week that the Players' Championship was diminished because John Rahm isn't there or Brooks Koepka isn't there. The kind of guys who are serious top stars who can play in major championships can't play in a PGA Tour event. Do you subscribe to that idea that the tournament was in any way worse off for their absence?
I don't think people are not turning on the Players' Championship because John Rahm isn't there or Brooks Koepka isn't there. Certainly, it's not as strong as a field. I think I counted 9 of the top 50 players in the world, or maybe 60 players in the world that are with LIV, weren't in that field that could have been had they chosen to stay with the PGA Tour. And their argument would be the opposite if, you know, the tour had been cooperative and let them play. But I'm sure, Eamon, that those players on the LIV Tour know that their choice now was really for the money grab and not for really anything else.
Certainly how it's unspooled thus far, but more to be determined with these ongoing negotiations. He is Brad Faxon with NBC Golf. Thanks for joining us, Fax.
Thanks, George. Thanks, Eamon.